Welcome to I Had to Say It, the podcast where I talk about things that I feel need talking about, and sometimes they're not getting the attention they deserve. And your feelings, they're not under consideration. The podcast you are about to listen to contains at least one of the following: strong language, disturbing topics, abusive opinions, generally things that aren't appropriate for little kids or overly sensitive people. So, if any of that stuff's going to get your nose out of joint, this is your chance to turn it off.
All right, so, hi everybody. Today I have my very first guest. I have Ariel Cooksey, who is the host of the podcast Malice, which is a true crime podcast. Honestly, the first real true crime thing I got into, which I'm putting that directly on you because it's a different format than what I've seen with other people doing true crime. You have the narrative, and then you do the follow-up episodes with your feelings about it and your information on it. And honestly, that's the first time I've encountered that. I mean, it may be out there. I don't know. Like I said, I'm not really a true crime guy, or at least I wasn't. Between you and a couple other people, I guess I'm a convert now. That was always more my wife's thing, really. She is, you know, all the way back to Unsolved Mysteries and Who the Bleep Did I Marry and all those ones, you know, and Snapped. And I don't know how many times I've come home and gone, if I piss her off, they're never going to find the body. I'm done. And there's been a few times where, like, we've been in the car and stuff, and I'll be playing an episode through the car's stereo, you know, with the Bluetooth. And she's sitting there, and she'll know something about the case just based on, like, the buildup information.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, that's the lady that fed her husband to the pigs, or
right.
That's the guy who had 37 bodies in his crawl space. And I'm going, I don't even know. Okay.
It's there's that true crime lover right there.
She,
in the same way.
Yeah, it seems to be a lot of the people in my life these days are all about knowing where the bodies are.
Look, handy skills. That's all I'm saying.
Well, like I said, that's just, it keeps me behaving. Like, I mean, I'm not the kind of guy, I like to think I have a pretty strong moral core where I wouldn't do anything that requires me getting whacked, but
sure.
It's also reaffirming to know, like, dude, she could make it look like an accident. I mean, knowing my wife, she'd probably just kink the hose on my breathing machine while I'm sleeping. You must have rolled over. That's the damnedest thing. It looks like the cat was chewing on the power cord or something. I don't know. God bless her. But, you know, like I said, I try not to give her any reasons to want to murder me in my sleep. So
right. You know, generally good. Good way to go about life.
Well, in general, yeah. I mean,
sure.
I try to be decent. That's kind of one of my reoccurring things I'm always talking about is stop being such a bunch of shitheads, you know? And
yeah,
I just, something in my makeup does not allow me to be a hypocrite for whatever reason. So I try to live the stuff instead of just like being out there going, hey, you should be decent people. And it's like, I really don't think it's hard to do. So,
right.
I mean, yeah, it can be. I don't want to act like I'm some kind of saint. There are I've spent 25 years in the service industry. There's been a lot of times where I've wanted to strangle somebody, and you know the difference is I don't. So, that's actually kind of how I got into doing the podcast thing was when I was working. I had a pressure release because I would get frustrated from dealing with people all day, but as a back of the house person, usually in a situation where the customers can't hear me or see me acting like an ass, I could just blow up. And usually all the other twisted individuals that are food service people would laugh right along with me and be like, you're right.
If you've ever worked food service, my God,
they're a different breed, particularly when you get to lifers. I mean, I think we all go through it at some point, but when you get somebody that's willing to commit that long to being in that pressure cooker /
oh God,
there's something wrong with us. And I worked with catering department for one of the local culinary schools here. And I was kind of, it was before they instituted having teacher's assistants, but that's basically, I was a TA. And it was kind of one of those things where we'd get these incoming freshmen and you'd get the grizzled old guys that just finally wanted that piece of paper that said they knew their stuff. And they just kind of would look at me and be like, because at the time I was in my mid 20s, I wasn't anything impressive to these guys. They're like, yeah, whatever, you're still wet behind the ears. But then we'd get the like high school kids that are coming out like, I'm going to be the next famous chef. And, oh boy. And I'd be looking at them going, if you're doing this because you think you're going to get rich, stop. If you don't have something wrong with you, you will if you keep up with this.
I mean, it rubs off a little bit, you know, but that's one of those things. And people laugh at me about this, but pretty much from birth until 25, people are babies to me.
Without a doubt.
Just sweet, precious little baby angels. Oh, like they're.
You get them and it's just like, oh, honey, did you hear what just came out of your mouth?
Right.
I used to get that a lot when I was even that age, because I've said it before here and there, but I've always been one of those people where people be like, dude, you're an old soul. Or I was a little kid, like way over serious. And maybe it was just because I was weird, but like my mom even said, like, when you were a baby, you didn't make any sense to me because you never slept and you started doing all these things like this little old man and you'd be walking around griping at three. And I was like, that makes sense.
Tracks. Yep.
Yeah. And I haven't really gotten any better. I've just gotten older with less hair and more chins. And the thing about it is, though, my mom used to say about the whole not sleeping thing. She's like, you wouldn't cry. You weren't colicky or anything. But I'd come in to check on you at like midnight just to see if you were okay. And you'd be in there standing at the edge of your crib, holding onto the railing, looking at me like you were disappointed. I'm like, are you sure that's not your baggage, Mom? I mean, I'm not trying to psychoanalyze you here or anything, but that sounds more like a toddler can't really look at an adult with disappointment, can they? And she goes, you did. I'm just, nope. All right, if you say so. She's like, oh yeah, and you were little and grandma used to parade you around. And it's like, I don't know, I don't exactly have an eidetic memory, but I do retain stuff pretty. I used to be really smart, but too many years in the industry that kind of warped it a little bit, but I used to retain things really well. And I do have these memories of like being a little kid in a time frame where it's like a lot of people don't retain stuff from that age, but whatever. And
sure.
I started really reading very early on. Like I could functionally read and comprehend at like three.
That is pretty amazing when people can do that. Yeah.
But that was one of those other things where people are like, oh, he's got such an old soul. And like, no, he's just wired weird. And like my grandmother at one point, I have a couple older cousins that were old enough. They were in like middle school and they were in theater. And they were reading lines for some school play or something. And I was sitting there because we were some family thing. And I was sitting there going through and I was following on the script. And I got to one part and I'm like, what's this word? That word's wrong. And they were like, you don't know that. You're three. that doesn't have a PH or that doesn't have a C. It's got a P. And they're like, it was like a phonetic F instead of C or whatever. And
oh, God.
So they start freaking out and they pick me up and take me down into the kitchen where all the family's like gathered around the table getting dinner ready. And they're like, he can read. I'm like, and my uncle, who was the oldest of all my mom's siblings, is like, he's three, he can't read. And he was their dad. He's like, he's too little to be reading. He's just following the words and he's probably picking things up from you talking. They're like, no, he asked questions. And my grandmother from like across the room goes, oh no, he can read. Put something in front of him. And I remember my grandma sitting in the chair on the opposite side of the kitchen going, no, give him something to read, Bill. And so my uncle's like, okay, this is a load of crap. And he went and got the newspaper and set it down in front of me. And I was like, today, yesterday, council said, what's a council? And like asking stupid questions about whatever this article he put in front of me was. And he looks at my mom and goes, how did you do that? And my mom just goes, he did it. We just read to him when he was little and he wouldn't sleep and he started reading to himself.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I know in my family's case, you know, I'm the middle of three kids and we're all kind of different ages, but we all just started spontaneously reading at one point.
Yeah.
Like one day we didn't have to go through like the flashcards or, you know, phonetic hunks and chunks, like they call them at my daughter's school. Yeah. It's just
any
sort of
stuff they got now.
Right. I mean, and that's all great, you know, but like I went into kindergarten reading, you know, I was, I guess about four when I started reading, you know, that it's not terribly common, but it's also, you know, there are lots of kids who just spontaneously, whenever they're ready, whenever their brain's
start
there.
Start going.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Maybe it says something that we're all attracted to doing this kind of stuff too. There's a type.
There is a type. Yeah.
And I got to be honest, doing the whole podcast, I think I've actually, like I said, I kind of got into it with the downtime. And for me, it was a release valve. And I'd like to get into why you started doing it too. But I've just met so many different cool people. But I keep finding these little threads where it's like, you know, I never would have thought we had that in common. But all right, rock and roll. Cool.
Right.
So I guess just kind of to like I've sort of outlined for anybody that's listening, I mean, obviously I don't have a huge audience at the moment, and whoever does listen to it, I really encourage them to go check out your show. But I wanted to just kind of ask, why did you start doing true crime stuff? I mean, in the interest of being prepared, I don't want to be all like creepy or anything. I did do a little due diligence and like Google you and stuff. So I do know a little bit of your background.
Sure.
If you'd like to bring it up and talk about that stuff.
Sure. But, no, I'm an open book. So. Yeah,
but I mean, what made you decide to go, I want to talk about all these situations where things kind of horribly happened and delve deeper into it?
I've always been fascinated by what makes people tick. So that kind of played out in a lot of different ways in my life. I was an actress for about 20 years. You know, and you have to be able to empathize in order to be convincing when you're an actor. but I also, my mom told me I always had this really strong sense of justice, like wanting to see things. She said when I was four, I saw, it was winter time and I saw a homeless man, on the side of the road. And, he didn't have a coat. And so I asked my mom if I could give him my coat, and it wouldn't have done him much good as tiny as I was, but it was one of those things that was just sort of, and I don't know, maybe it was because I was a middle child. And so I was often like the mediator between my siblings, you know, and also, you know, keenly aware that like, well, he gets all the privileges and responsibilities and my little sister gets babied. So, and then here I am in the middle, like middle child syndrome, maybe. Just a touch.
But on the other hand, it's a early sign of character too. You shouldn't slight that. It's, you know, not everybody has it. I mean, just being honest, there are people out there that are about as stand up as a slice of wet white bread. So
I've covered a few.
Yeah, a couple of seasons worth.
Yeah, but yeah. So I guess I was in fourth grade. And my family took a trip to San Antonio. This is an unusual thing. We were very poor growing up. But we were on the Riverwalk and there was this giant bookstore at the very end of it. And while we did not have a lot of money, my mom had a hard time turning down getting books if we wanted books, you know? So, she told us we could each pick out two. And I stumbled upon these books, children's books, let's put a pin in that. Okay. We'll come back to it. I found these books called Be the Judge, Be the Jury. And that appealed to me because I was also into those like choose your own adventure books and that kind of thing. Where it was like, I want to say in the matter, right? So
I think I read all of those when I was a kid.
Yes. It's you know, never short of opinions, right? So I should be able to weigh in on these things. So the two that I picked, one was The Trial of Alger Hiss, who was a double agent. He worked for the CIA during the Red Scare and was ultimately found guilty of treason. And then there was also the other one that I got, children's books, just was The Trial of Lizzie Borden.
Oh, lovely.
Uh-huh. And so I, you know how they have like pictures sometimes like right before you get into the chapter?
Yeah, the little header pictures.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're going to pause right here for a quick break. And then we'll come back to more of the interview.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So anyone who doesn't know, Lizzie Borden was put on trial for bludgeoning her father and stepmother to death with a hatchet. And this picture was of her father with his face unrecognizable in the crime scene photo.
Yeah, that wouldn't hit the shelves today.
No. And so I was 9, and I'm going to borrow the expression from My Favorite Murder, but in this purely murderino way, I was like, this is terrible. I need to know everything.
Yeah.
So
I can completely see that.
Yeah. So I guess I was bitten by the bug pretty early. I loved unsolved mysteries. Anytime Forensics Files came on, I was just kind of, fascinated with that. And I really am, weirdly, I am fascinated by the forensic side of things. Like, you know, my schooling is in, you know, like the more soft sciences kind of stuff, but the fact that these people are so ingenious in how they test for these things, it's just mind boggling. So basically I went to school on a scholarship for musical theater and I am not a competitive person is all I can tell you. Not a good fit for theater. Yeah. So I changed my major, I changed universities, and I switched to, because I'm also super indecisive, psychology, women's studies, and English literature. So I'm degreed in all of those.
So a triple threat, which...
None of which will get you a job.
Yeah, it's not entirely true. You could get a job teaching those particular things.
If you're lucky.
Another degree out of that, if you're lucky.
Yeah.
If somebody dies, I mean,
so I basically was like, I got done and I started working with emotionally disturbed children.
That can be a lot.
It was a lot. And I loved the kids. We were all paired with campuses where our strengths were geared towards the population of emotionally disturbed children. So I was sent to a campus that had, I mean, this was K-5, and these kids tended to be more along the lines of self-harm, and, you know, several of them had suicidal ideations, attempts, not really, but like, they needed somebody who was stable and somebody who could, you know, be that sort of connect with them on an emotional level. Cause a lot of them, you know, had these problems because of dysfunctional home lives and the things they were witnessing. That's not always the case in emotional disturbance, but you see it a lot. And of the 13 kids that I had, 10 of them had had active CPS cases for sexual assault against them.
Oh, geez.
So that's related to self-harm in a lot of cases among children who don't understand really what's happening to them. So anyway, it was very difficult. And I was at a stage in my life where I couldn't go home without taking it with me. And I realized after a while, I just couldn't do that anymore.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So I went back to school and got my master's degree in sociology. And then my doctoral work was in social psychology. I wasn't planning on pursuing a doctorate, but my professors were like, you're an idiot if you walk with a master's degree. You need to do this. You're good at it. And I'm the first person to tell you that I suck at things and the things I suck at, right? But I also think it's important, and here's one of those I had to say at moments, I think it's important for people to recognize the things they're good at. It's okay to realize that you're good at things and to give yourself that credit. So
definitely. Not enough people do that.
You don't want me doing your taxes, but
well, that's okay. That's where I'm good. I'm very creative with numbers and stuff. I actually, some of the coursework I went back to school for since being laid off is accounting stuff. Because I was like, well, looking at my assorted stuff I've gotten into over the years, and like when I was working with the college with the culinary program, I was taking classes the whole time because they were paid for. And why not? I'm not the guy to walk away from free anything.
Right.
So
amen.
So I got my culinary degree, which it's an associate's. It's not, I just early on, I figured out as bright as I was, I didn't have the proper temperament for academia.
Oh God. I didn't either. I loved the classwork.
The culture
was garbage.
Yeah, no, I'm not that guy. And since, especially in my younger days when I was kind of a hothead and really had no filter, I mean, I had a few instances even going back to high school where it's like, they would have thrown me out if they could get away with it. But
just on the side of the line.
Well, no, it was really more like thumbing my nose at the line instead of towing it because as a kid, I was fairly gifted. I was in like accelerated learning programs and crap like that. And so when high school rolled around, I started taking AP courses.
Sure.
My junior year, I was taking a full AP load. So I was doing double credits on everything. My whole senior year was basically a blow off. I was in my hometown, like the music program is a really big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Like my high school band competed at a collegiate level.
Yeah.
And I was in the symphonic band and played band and I played football, did some sports. It was in the yearbook, but my senior year was all like classes I either left the campus for or like I had to go to the local college for some of my classes, and I had enough credits to graduate where I could have just walked, but I was in all these other programs where I didn't want to leave school.
Sure.
I didn't want to quit the band. I mean, we took second place at nationals my senior year and first place my junior year. And that's at a AAA collegiate level. So it was like, it was a big deal. The trophy was like 6 feet tall. It was a big trophy.
Whoa.
I didn't want to walk away from that. That was awesome.
Right.
And I was like the co-graphic design editor for our yearbook where we were going through and like, basically it was a glorified retoucher. We went through and cleaned up pictures
and
you know, unblurred people's faces or, you know, things like that. It was not anything glorious, but it gave me an excuse to hang out in the computer lab all day.
Sure.
And, you know, and that was back in the 90s. So it was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, so I, but that was kind of like well known throughout the faculty that I was there more or less because I wanted to be, not because I had to be.
Yeah.
And I kind of was a cocky ass about the whole thing because like I took accounting class my senior year, but it was first period. And for me at the time, I was just really early to be in school. I 7:30. I wanted to go have breakfast or something.
Right. Gross.
And
I'm not a person.
Oh, me neither. And, but the teacher was trying to handle it like, oh, I'm getting you ready for college. Well, no, you're doing the same thing all the high school teachers say, where they're like, college, they're not going to let you slack off. And as opposed to, you know, your professor coming in in his pajamas.
Mm-hmm.
So this guy, the first day of class says, in this course, you're going to work on the computers and you're going to work at your own pace. And mm-hmm. as long as you meet these benchmarks, that's what your grade's based on. And I looked at this little syllabus that he handed us, and there was nothing on there about attendance. There was nothing on there about, you know, being in class. It just said, have your work done by these dates.
Yep.
And that was on a Monday. On Thursday, I handed him the entire semester's worth of homework and said, I'll see you for finals. And he was like, you can't do that. And I said, it doesn't say anywhere in this syllabus that I can't do that. It says, have the work done by these dates, and it's all done.
That's amazing.
Attendance is not mandatory. I'm not coming back to class. This is too damn early.
And oh my God, yeah.
Yeah. So he dragged me down to the dean's office and was like, Aaron is being insubordinate and subversive in the class. And I brought all my books and the paper with him. And I said, this is what he handed us on day one.
Mm-hmm.
Nowhere in that paper does it state anything about attendance being relevant to my grade. I handed him all the homework. If I screwed up, he can flunk me because it's wrong. Mm-hmm. But I kept a copy of this, and I'm going to compare it to whatever he turns in for my grades. And if there's one thing that's wrong with it, I want to pass automatically, and I want him written up. And he looked at me and he goes, what do you think you're doing? I said, you're trying to punish me. We're keeping this fair. And
yep,
like my mom actually was worked in the school district with ED and LD kids too. And like my grandmother was a principal, and a bunch of my cousins were involved in as educators. So I kind of had a little mm-hmm. bit of a family reputation within the system as well. And they just kind of looked at me and went, okay, you know, technically you're right, but you're being an ass about this. And I went, technically I'm going to drop my little brother off for class in the morning, because I have a younger brother who I had a car. So he rode to school with me. I was like, I'm going to drop him off, and then I'm going down the cafe down the street, and I'm going to have breakfast and a cup of coffee, and then I'm going to come back to second period because I don't have to go to his class.
That's fantastic.
And they looked at the paper, looked at him, and they said, you might want to revise this because he's kind of got you on this one. And they said, could you at least be decent about it? And I said, no, have you heard him lecture? He's boring as hell. I'm not coming in for this every morning. And they kind of looked at me and went, ugh. And so I went to the cafe down the street for breakfast every morning for the rest of the semester.
That is awesome.
And
I'll tell you though, I mean, yeah. People didn't care for me much when I was in my master's program, because I fucked the curve like on the regular. So one semester, get this, I'm taking 6 hours, teaching 9 hours. I'm defending my master's thesis, and I gave birth 3 days before the semester started.
Oh, Jesus.
And because I didn't want to have to spend all that time doing schoolwork during the semester, I turned in all my work on the 10th day of the semester. And all of a sudden, everyone else's excuses were bullshit.
Oh yeah, no, that is fan friggin' tastic. I applaud you dearly for that. That is, I love it.
They were just like, how the fuck did you do this? And I was like, because I have a brand new baby, and because I can't sleep anyway, and so I might as well get this shit done. I mean,
exactly.
One of the classes was just like 10 chapters worth, and a reflection paper on each chapter.
Oh, God,
yeah. It's like one page paper. That's the perfect thing. What?
That's the perfect assignment to do at 2 o'clock in the morning when the baby's colicky.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So,
Say, I would have been in that class like, right on. And probably they would all focused on hitting me instead.
Oh, God. I'm just, it's, and I'm fine with it. It is what it is. Yeah. Not everybody's going to like me, and I'm thoroughly okay with that. You know, I think it used to affect me more, but anyway, so I started doing this doctoral work, and most people who do sociology or psychology, first of all, they butt heads, but also they tend to be interested more in the statistical side of things, quantitative research. And there's almost nobody who really likes theory classes because they're very, very hard to interpret and the nuance and this and that. Theory was my jam, man. I mean, I was like, this is amazing. This is teaching me so much. And I would argue with things in it, and I would argue with my professors, like right in class. And people were just like, how are you doing this? Why are you doing this? Like, there was a professor once who made a statement about how, what was it? Breast augmentation was not feminist. And boy, did I fucking chew him out in class. And I even, the guy was Persian, okay? Oh. And I straight up, like, the conversation turned to high heels at one point, and he just said, like, those were definitely invented by a man. And I said, yeah, you're absolutely right. They were originally used by Persian horse riders, sir. Do your goddamn homework. And then at some point in time, he just was like, he just started laughing, and he was like, all right, you got me. I don't know.
Yeah, well, what can you say to that? Just, nuh-uh.
No. God, but
no, we didn't.
I mean, it was just too hilarious to me. But like, basically, because I loved theory and because I was real bad at stats. I mean, technically I got through like doctoral advanced statistics. I think it was a pity thing and they didn't want me in class again. So bless their hearts, they're saints. So ultimately, though, I just realized that I was interested in both psychology and sociology. And I think that you can't pull them apart. They're inextricable. Like, the social structures that exist affect our psychology. And our psychology, in turn, affects how we perpetuate those social structures or how they change. And, you know, so for me, it's like a micro to macro kind of understanding. But I've always been interested in how we form our identities. And that's where this all started, really. How do we form our identities? How do we maintain them? What's the difference between our perceived identity and the identities that people put on us socially? You know, like those kinds of questions kind of emerged in me, and it got me interested more in deviant behavior and social control. And deviance in sociology is just, it's different from the aggregate. Normal just means this is what most people do. It's not good, it's not bad, it is what it is. But I did research dealing with bioethics, and like, there is a, and I can't remember what it's called now, I think it's housed under body dysmorphic disorder, but individuals who had amputee identity disorder, I know the labels changed, but people who were deeply troubled by the fact that they felt that they had limbs that they shouldn't. And, you know, people would say, like, well, a doctor can't operate on this person who's otherwise well. And I was like, well, but are they neglecting the mental health of this person? And I think that it's important to point out in this that 98%, that is huge, 98% of people who successfully had limbs removed had a complete alleviation of symptoms of psychological distress. So, I mean, Yeah. So going into the bioethics, and I didn't necessarily make an argument either way. It was just like, this should be explored. We need to think about this from more angles. But ultimately, looking at deviant behavior, I mean, violent criminals. I wanted to know what made them tick. Why do people become so pathological in their behaviors?
It's a really good question.
Yeah. And so when I first started listening to podcasts, you know, I had just left a job where I was working to help establish a safe baby court in the child welfare system, which is basically, I mean, it sounds like, what is that? But infants and toddlers make up 80% nationwide and 80% in the state of Texas, where I'm from, of children in child welfare. And they're largely pre-verbal, and they can't, they're therefore the most vulnerable population.
Yeah.
And, you know, in cases of neglect or drug abuse or things like that with birth parents, a lot of times having their child taken is enough of an impetus to try to fix those things. Some of them just simply lack the education, you know. And so this program introduced co-parenting relationships between birth parents and foster parents. So the foster parents would sort of mentor the birth parent, and in hopes of keeping the birth parent in the child's life. So even if they ultimately did have to relinquish custody of their child, they could still be involved in their child's life. And I've seen it successfully happen multiple times. And others, they would end up doing everything they needed to do, getting clean, getting mental health help, and ultimately be able to be reunified with their child. So
very cool.
Yeah, it's very cool. But through doing that, I met a lot of birth parents who people would discount and say, God, some people just shouldn't be mothers. Or, you know, that woman, you know, oh God, I remember somebody saying at one of these visits I was observing, somebody saying, I think after one or two kids are taken by CPS, you should have to have a compulsory hysterectomy. And I just thought, that is so sick. That's so sick. Like, you know, one day I, you know, and I think this is one of the things that affected me most profoundly in terms of looking at offenders, in terms of they didn't start out this way. Now, when I look at birth parents, a lot of times, and particular this woman, I just look at it and I think this is just god awful. But when I met her, she was at a visit with her 2 week old infant, and she just had tears, just these very quiet tears rolling down her cheeks. She never looked away from that child. Even when people were speaking to her, she'd respond. She could not take her eyes off that baby, but she already knew that baby was going to be taken from her. And it was probably for the best. And basically, one of the things that I used to do is after those visits, I would go outside and I would carry a pack of cigarettes with me. And I would offer a cigarette, because those were really emotional things. And the vast majority of them would smoke. Some of them were like, no, thank you. You know, but we'd just sit down on the curb. And that's what happened with her, is we just sat down. And I just started kind of talking with her, and she ended up opening up about her life. And this woman, she, again, this was her ninth child taken, but when she was 10 years old, her father started pimping her out to gangs for heroin money. Jeez. And in order to keep her compliant, both the gangs and her father would dope her up. And she essentially was, by 14 years old, she was a full-blown gang ho, and that's the expression they use. It's not one I would, but just so that it's explicit what was happening. She was being passed around, and so her first baby she had when she was 15. And once the child was of age, she actually sought out her mother, and they had a functional relationship at that point, which is good.
Good then.
I mean, she seemed like just such a loving, lovely person, but how do you start at 10 years old, fed into that system, and not end up in a position where you lack the resources to be a functional adult?
Yeah, that's really not something you can hold them responsible for. That's one of those things where my inner indignant flares up, because that is just, you're the bottom rung if you're somebody that does that to a child, as far as I'm concerned. And
right.
Like, I generally, I mean, if you've listened to some of my episodes,
yes.
you know where I stand. I'm kind of a belligerent ass about stop being such a bunch of rotten people.
Right.
I got to admit, you know, I have my own facet where I know I have the capacity to be just a horrible bastard.
Sure.
But it's always in reaction to something like that.
Yeah.
So this is where we're going to break off the interview for this week. We'll come back next Friday with another portion of the interview between Ariel Cooksey, the host of Malice the Podcast, True Crime Stories, and myself. I hope you guys are enjoying it as much as we enjoyed talking to each other and getting to know each other a little bit. And I cannot stress enough, if you're into true crime stuff, or even if you're not, check out Malice. It's a fantastic podcast. It's available on every platform. And she's fantastic. She's a really smart lady, and I can't stress it enough. Go check out her show. Seriously. And other than that, I hope you guys have a great week, and that's what I had to say. Thanks for listening to another episode of I Had to Say It. If you liked what you heard, leave a review, give us a follow, give me some feedback. And if you didn't like what you heard, leave a review, give me a follow, give me some feedback. I'll try and fix it. Check us out on all the social media platforms at I Had to Say It Podcast is the trigger for all that stuff, for the search term. And if you want, check out the website, www.ihadtosayitpodcast.com. There's links to people that have been involved with the program, things I've talked about. There are some links available for some merch that we're working on, and there are ways to contact us there as well. And thanks for listening, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.